This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
As you know, the world is a mess. We have more emergencies than ever. We have more refugees than ever. And we are struggling on all fronts to help the people be able to feed themselves.
That's Bettina Lusher of the World Food Program. Details next. Also, Kenya is set to be the first African country to introduce better HIV treatment for people living with the disease. And as part of his campaign to battle corruption and abuse of office, Gambian President Adama Barrow has told his ministers to declare their assets before July 15th. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a World Food Program review of the global hunger situation in 2016 finds conflict emergencies in the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere are hampering United Nations efforts to achieve zero hunger by the year 2030. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on WFP's report, 2016, a year in fighting hunger.
The United Nations reports 795 million people in the world went hungry last year. World Food Programme spokeswoman Bettina Lusher tells VOA the Sustainable Development Goal to eliminate hunger by 2030 does not, for now, appear realistic.
As you know, the world is a mess. We have more emergencies than ever. We have more refugees than ever. And we are struggling on all fronts to help the people be able to feed themselves.
Last year, WFP assisted more than 82 million people with food or cash. While that is a lot, Lusher agrees it is far from enough. She says escalating conflicts are making the work of aid agencies much harder. She says countries that had been making progress in development have gone backwards because of conflict. She points to South Sudan as an example of a country which on the eve of independence appeared poised to prosper after decades of civil war.
And look what happened. They went back to fighting. And for the first time in 6 years, this year we saw in some areas of South Sudan a famine again. And that is just unbelievable in this time in our new century. It's just unbelievable. So the conflicts have to stop.
Lucia says it takes money to fight hunger. Unfortunately, she says international support is waning at a time of burgeoning emergencies. She says WFP urgently needs $1 billion to fight four looming famines in Yemen, Somalia, South Sudan, and in northeast Nigeria. She says it will be extremely difficult to save people dying from hunger without help from international donors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Italy is warning of a new migrant emergency following a surge of new arrivals in recent days, and media reports say tens of thousands more migrants are getting ready to leave Libya to try to cross the Mediterranean. Reporter Josephine Makeda is following the story. From Rome, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
In the past few days, we've seen 10,000 people saved in the Mediterranean by various vessels. And some of them have arrived in Italy, some of them are still on their way. But the Italian government, in particular the Interior Minister Marco Minniti, is very concerned about this. It's considered to be an emergency. He's cancelled a trip to Washington to respond to overcrowding that's taking place in the migrant centres in Italy. And the government is now looking at using army barracks and tents to respond to this new wave of migrants that have arrived. As you know, we've seen 70,000 arrivals since the beginning of the year, and there are media reports here saying that there are 90,000 others ready to leave Libya over the next 3 months to make that journey across the Mediterranean to Europe.
Has he called any emergency meetings to talk about this crisis?
In Interior Minister Mark Romiti will be meeting the Italian Prime Minister Paolo Gentiloni this evening to discuss the crisis and how they can move forward. There's still concern in Italy that the other members of the European Union are not pulling their weight, they're not taking enough migrants, and Italy is being forced to bear the burden of this wave that we're seeing, particularly in the last couple of weeks.
Now, earlier this week, we spoke about the situation in Ventimiglia when several hundred migrants sort of disappeared from the camp there to try to sneak into France, but they were hidden in the countryside. What's the latest?
Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, says it's very concerned about the condition of around 100 migrants who disappeared in Ventimiglia. The police moved in on several hundred migrants that had been camped in the river there in the town, which is, of course, on the border of France. Now the Red Cross has taken in extra migrants in a camp that they have there, a migrant centre, which is quite crowded. MSF says that some of the patients that they have dealt with in the past have simply disappeared. They're very concerned about unaccompanied children. Officials said that they had been asking local authorities for a solution, and they said it was completely unacceptable that people had been camped out along the river in very unfavourable conditions. And they also said that one 16-year-old boy had lost his life while simply washing his personal possessions down by the river. Now, MSF has treated nearly 1,500 migrants in Ventimiglia since the beginning of 2017, and it's very concerned about the conditions for migrants. Many of those who had been camped by the river were Sudanese, and we're still not sure what's happened to them.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Kenya is said to be the first African country to introduce better HIV treatment for people living with the disease that causes AIDS. In partnership with the Kenyan government, UNITAID and the World Health Organization have introduced a generic first-line drug for people living with HIV. From Nairobi, Lenny Ruvaga reports for VOA.
Speaking at a news conference in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, Dr. Peter Kimu, the head of the health policy and planning at the Ministry of Health, said this new first-line drug, known as dolutegravir or DTG, has few side effects and patients living with HIV are less likely to develop resistance.
DTG offers better tolerability, fewer adverse drug reactions, fewer drug-to-drug interactions, and higher genetic barrier to resistance.
One of the key partners in the initiative is UNITAID, a global health initiative working to end tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS epidemic. UNITAID donated approximately 148,000 bottles of DTG to Kenya's health ministry, which will cover about 1% of the patients living with HIV in the country. Robert Matiru, the director of operations at UNITAID, told VOA the economic and health benefits of the new line of treatment will go a long way in ensuring key populations get much-needed treatment.
When you bring a better product that is cheaper to make and that is of higher efficacy, meaning better treatment outcomes, of course you're going to realize savings. And savings are so critical in this day and age because, as we know, funding is constrained and in some cases declining.
According to Kenya's health ministry, about 1.5 million people are living with HIV. The introduction of the new generic first-line drug will be an added arsenal in the fight against the scourge. Speaking to VOA at the launch of the new drug, Dr. Martin Sirengo, the head of the National AIDS and STI Control Program, or NASCOP, was upbeat about the new line of treatment. However, he says challenges still exist.
We have a challenge in the sense that DTG is not available commercially to the scale that we can start everyone on it. It's a new drug, so the manufacturing is yet to catch up. That's why we're starting small. Number two, we have moved the treatment from where we used to combine different pills to make a regimen into what we call a fixed-dose combination pill, which is basically a tablet containing three drugs. DTG is a single drug, so we have to formulate the regimen with other two drugs.
Doti Ogutu, the executive director at African Sex Workers Alliance, an organization that addresses human and health rights violations against sex workers, has been living with HIV for the last 15 years. Ogutu has been on dolutegravir for 3 months. She says the difference between this new line of treatment compared to the old one is the diminished side effects that go along with taking the medication.
The side effects are significantly less. I haven't experienced any side effects using it, so I think that's just my experience. But, you know, with treatment, it differs from patient to patient. But what I can attest to is that the side effects of this one, if I compare with the side effects I had with the favirans, whereby I had a loss of weight, loss of appetite, I became severely anemic, and that became basically my condition. I haven't been able to experience that with this new drug. So I think it's a plus that we are now changing to medication that's being used in developed countries.
However, Ogutu, whose organization African Sex Workers Alliance has membership in 30 African countries, argues that more focus should be shifted to adherence.
There's a challenge, and even for those who are living with HIV, adherence, sticking to the drugs and finishing your drugs. There's a lot more that still needs to be done around providing psychosocial support for people who are living with HIV. And I think we are losing it in all this conversation around prevention. And I think it should be a slogan in this year's World AIDS Day. People living with HIV, lives matter.
According to the World Health Organization, more than 18 million people globally were receiving antiretroviral treatment. Dolutegravir is set to be introduced in two other early adopter countries, Nigeria and Uganda. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. ISIS and other extremist groups across the Middle East have been attacking and uprooting Christians in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere. And in recent months, Egyptian Copts, the largest Christian minority in the region, have faced grave security threats. Magdi Khalil is a member of the U.S.-based group Coptic Solidarity, a nonprofit human rights organization. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about attacks on Copts in Egypt with a culture of impunity for the culprits.
The main responsible is the governance, because the responsibility of the government to protect the minorities. This is the rule of government. But a long time ago, they left radical groups to grow underground. So now we face a really tragedy situation. Middle East Christian now was 28 million outside the Middle East and just 15 million inside the Middle East. So Egyptian Christian will be zero before 2050.
So you are fearful about the future of Christians in Egypt?
Sure, in Egypt, exactly. Because almost nil in Iraq. In Syria, we don't know what is the future. Till now, everything is under chaos. But in Egypt now, they focusing to get rid of Egyptian Christians in Egypt now. So we face real ethnic cleaning in Egypt.
So what do you recommend to counter this phenomenon?
Now, as you know, local ISIS in Egypt are very dangerous against everything in Egypt. And the army, people, police can protect themselves, but nobody protect the Egyptian Christians in Egypt. So the weak point in Egypt is Egyptian Christians in Egypt. Copts in Egypt is the weak point for local ISIS. So they said we will target Christians in Egypt.
Are you satisfied with the Egyptian government reaction to the attacks on Copts?
No. There is a lack of protection. There is impunity, lack of justice. There is no high-ranking position for Christians in Egypt, political positions.
What role do you see for education in creating a different environment where citizens are treated equally?
This is another point. Media and education system and media are against minority. From 1975 till this moment, education system and media system against equality, against Christians in Egypt, against non-Muslims. So also need a lot of work, long-term work. But now, short-term work, you have to protect these minorities, protect the churches, to consider churches as like military places.
Do you see any role for the U.S. in protecting the rights of religious minorities in Egypt?
Under Trump administration, they are serious. We met with White House representative. They are serious to protect and to stop killing, as Mr. Trump said. You must stop killing Christians in Egypt and the Middle East. So there is a different administration, different thinking, very serious more than Obama administration.
But sometimes the U.S. is focusing more on stability at the expense of human rights, especially with the conflict.
I agree with you, but at the other side, they said excellent things about Christians in Egypt, and they already spoke with Sisi about Christians many times, but it's not in public. They told us we spoke many times with Sisi, but not in public. We need to achieve something, as not to just publicize these issues.
That was Magdi Khalil, a member of the U.S.-based group Coptic Solidarity, a nonprofit organization defending human rights of the Copts of Egypt. Gambian President Adama Barrow has told his ministers to declare their assets before July 15th. It's part of his campaign to battle corruption and abuse of office. Barrow came to power last December after defeating longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh in a highly contested election. Among those observing the new administration in The Gambia is Dr. Ismaila Cisse, a political science professor at the University of The Gambia. Reporter Panderam Bai asked for his reaction to President Barrow's move to hold his cabinet ministers accountable.
It's a good move once it's done properly. Just the statement itself should not just be taken in as face value, saying that they'll just declare their assets. And for me, I think it came a bit too late, because they should have done this 6 months ago, though. Within 6 months, a lot of things could have happened there. But nonetheless, I think it's a good start. Let's just wait till mid-July to see what they will declare and how they are going to do it.
Do you think it's going to be an effective means of combating, let's say, corruption in Gambia?
It's a statement by the Barrow government to show how serious they are in fighting and combating corruption and sleaze among public officials. So I think it's a good move. Once it's done properly, I think it will send a right message across that his government will not tolerate sleaze and corruption among public officials. They must set the example. It has to start there at the top to show that they are serious, so that it will trickle down to other government officials and civil servants below.
Based on what you gathered, is the president himself going to avail himself for scrutiny?
He must do that. If he tells the ministers to do it, he must do it as well. There's no point in telling the ministers to declare their assets whilst himself will not declare his assets. So we expect him to do that, and we expect all the ministers to do that. And this must be done publicly, not privately.
What are the key developmental challenges facing Gambians at this time?
Security is one. Security is one, and also the economy is two. Employment is three. Like we say, we are from 22 years of dictatorship, 22 years of institutional failure and governance failure. We have to understand that the Gambia is facing serious challenges both at the macro and at the micro level. And all these are challenges. But I think the most important challenges are security, economy and corruption, and also ethics within the civil service. There's lack of efficiency. There's lack of ethics. Civil servants do whatever they want to do. There is no prospect for the job. But I think the primary priority for the government is unity, to unite Gambians, because Gambians have never been divided along political and ethnic lines before, and this is a serious problem. And always when we have foreign troops in a country, this causes problems, especially when we have our own military officers who are not very happy with the situation at the moment. It's a delicate and very tricky situation whereby the government needs to be really careful how they handle this whole thing. And also, we have also another serious problem. We have a very youthful population, which is very explosive. Over 65% of our population are below 25 years of age, and they feel alienated. There are no jobs. Education system is a farce, and it's a recipe for disaster. And because of that kind of youthful, explosive population, it's a kind of a ticking, it's a volcano. I mean, we have to provide employment for the young people. We have to invest a lot of money on young people. Otherwise, it might just explode, because as we saw what happened in Farado, I was there, I saw how angry these youths were, and they feel so alienated. So all these things must be, and they are all interlinked.
Dr. Ismaila Cisse is a political science professor at the University of The Gambia. He spoke to reporter Pandera Mbai. The government of Burundi is calling on the European Union to impose conditions for lifting its ban on aid. The country's foreign affairs minister says Burundi is ready to renegotiate and resume cooperation. Moses Havyarimana has the story from Bujumbura.
It's been 2 years since the European Union suspended direct aid to the Burundian government. The EU took the action after rights violations were reported during the protests and violence that led to more than 500 people losing their lives. Political turmoil erupted after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek for a third term in April 2015. He won the re-election, but critics called the move unconstitutional and a violation of the Arusha Peace Accords. Hundreds of thousands of people fled to neighboring countries, and many opposition leaders are in exile. Burundi Foreign Affairs Minister Ali Nyamitwe says that Burundi is a sovereign state and no partner should impose conditions on the country.
We remain constrained by their interpretation of the Article 96 of the Cotonou Agreement. We have always criticized the one-sidedness and the unilateral decision made by that Council of Ministers of the European Union, because we do not believe that the dialogue session that we held on the 8th of December 2015 was fairly conducted by their side.
Article 96 provides a legal basis for suspension of agreement in cases where one of the parties believes the agreement's fundamental elements are not respected. That includes human rights abuses and activities that undermines democracy. Christian Joly is chargé d'affaires of European Union in Burundi.
Violations of human rights in Burundi, impunity against violators, and we still are concerned with these violations, with the ongoing impunity and the issue of governance in Burundi. So it is when progress in these areas will be recorded that the EU will be able to change its position on the appropriate measure under Article 96.
The Burundi government suspended cooperation with the United Nations Human Rights Office in the country after the release of a report by the UN Independent Investigation on Burundi. The report indicated widespread and systematic patterns of violations of human rights and that executions were carried out on a large scale. Burundi Foreign Affairs Minister Alain Nyamitwe says that offices were not closed, but rather suspended.
The office has not been closed. We have frozen the cooperation between that office and us, simply because a number of elements arose to make us understand that that office, or at least some of their dealings, were not necessarily in line with the purpose and mandate that they had agreed to with the government.
While Burundi is more stable now, forced disappearances, kidnappings and targeted killings are still being reported in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with the Voice of America director, Amanda Bennett, on her recent trip to Africa and VOA's Africa initiatives, including meeting with African government officials, affiliate executives, media members, journalism students, and the African youth.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.